Thank you. It's a pleasure to kick off the program of this third TMS Ethics workshop. Normally, I think of Santa Barbara as a beautiful place, but when the competition is Kyoto and Morea, it's less clear. It's at least a close battle between those three. And I am sorry if some of our TMS participants have a little bit of jet lag. It is a long trip. So most of this talk, the good news is, you don't even really need to think about electronic interactions. I will come back to some interacting stuff at the end. But basically, what I want to talk about is motivated by the question of, now that we have Weyl semimetals and we've established that there's this topological band structure, what do they do? What is an effect that you can measure, and in particular, an electromagnetic effect? And it turns out that that answers the following theoretical question, which is, we know the quantum Hall topological response very well, which is that I apply an electric field and I generate a two-dimensional current density, say. There are a couple of ways you could try to make nonlinear versions of that. And I'm going to argue that some Weyl semimetals have an effect which is of this form. The rate at which you create a 3D current density is a quantized multiple of E squared with no material dependent constants. But I need to build up to that a little bit. And the good news is there's an experiment now on the archive that sees at least part of what we were hoping to see. So, as you all know, the way that we originally found topological order was by an electromagnetic response. It was measuring the fact that in some two-dimensional electron materials, you get extremely precise quantization of the Hall conductance or conductivity, say an integer times E squared over H to maybe one part in a billion. And the point is, clearly this doesn't have any material-dependent factors, so it's the same whether you're measuring graphene or gallium arsenide or whatever. And that sort of macroscopic quantization, even in a sample with disorder and so on, is quite amazing and certainly has led to at least three Nobel Prizes so far. But there are other kinds of quantization that are a bit weaker and that don't require a gap. And this is more like what I'm going to talk about. So just that you're not expecting part in a billion quantization or something like that, let me tell you an experiment that I find pretty neat, and I think it's the shortest paper I've ever read in Science magazine. So if you take a sheet of graphene and you hold it up to the light, most of the light gets through, but about 2.3% gets blocked, and that 2.3% is pi times 1 over 137. In other words, it's pi times the vacuum fine structure constant. So that statement is not true to one part in a billion. It is true to better than one part in 10, close to one part in 100, I believe. But, for example, this is affected by the curvature of the bands of graphene. It ceases to be true if you go up to high enough frequency or if you go to very low frequency. So I don't think of this effect as particularly topological. So we're going to find something that is, in a way, in between this effect and the quantum Hall effect. So it has a topological origin, and it's somewhat more robust to things like band bending than this one, but it's probably not going to be perfect for various reasons, like the one in the quantum Hall effect. But as background, why should you care about nonlinear optical measurements of Weyl semimetals in the first place? Well, the reason why Weyl semimetals are interesting, at least one reason, is we thought for many years that the neutrino might be a Weyl fermion. It might be massless. And then people found that the neutrino has oscillations and hence has a mass. So the Weyl fermion is a particle that we don't think exists in the standard model of particle physics, but it exists as of 5 years ago in solids. And the theoretical idea that such things might happen goes back to the 1930s, but it's great to have a material example. Nonlinear optics in particular, first of all, if you take the standard most studied Weyl semimetal, tantalum arsenide, I'll show you a little bit of data later on from Joe Ornstein's group, but the nonlinear optical effects like second harmonic generation and maybe photocurrent as well are extremely strong. Chi2 is very large. That happens for reasons that I don't think are specifically topological or related to the Weylness. So I'll come to that. But if you go to different Weyl semimetals, so this is why I had certain Weyl semimetals in the title, if you have sort of chiral Weyl semimetals, which don't have mirror symmetries, then there's another nonlinear effect that is actually quantized. And then the third point is maybe that linear optics doesn't get these interesting things, I will claim. So the quick outline, and I'm not going to go through the basics of Berry phases and topological phases, because I think people here know that already. Just to quickly remind you that we know already in the insulating case several interesting electromagnetic responses from topological phases. Then the second point is, when we talk about semi-metals, what could we expect? And in particular, there are at least three things that have been floating around that the way I define them are all slightly different. One is the chiral magnetic effect, one is the chiral anomaly, and one that I'm going to talk about here mostly is the chiral photocurrent. And then I have a little bit on future directions. And then you'll see that we started off thinking about the linear problem, and it turned out, and many other people were thinking about this as well, that the linear problem in Weyl semimetals actually teaches you something about a very old piece of physics. It was a rate-limiting step to find materials that would show the new effect, and that was largely done by other groups, not by us, to find materials that would realize this effect, and then something we're working on now, but I don't think I'm quite ready to talk about in public, but I would be happy to talk in private, is about a more general understanding of this effect. So this is at least some of the people involved in the work. The top row is a bunch of theory, former Berkeley postdocs for the first three, Fernando De Juan, Adolfo Grushin, and Takahiro Morimoto, who just started a faculty position in Tokyo. Dan Parker is a Berkeley student graduating this year. And then for the experimental data I show, I can't show all the group members, but these are the three leaders of the experimental groups. It was a sample from Claudia Felser, conception for the experiment by Joe Orenstein, and it used a very nice setup by Darius Torchinsky at Temple. All right, so what I want to, just as a warm-up for people who don't think very much about optics, so symmetry and topology we now know have this intimate relationship. And in general, I'll say symmetry allows certain electromagnetic effects to be present, and then topology is what might give us quantization. So the symmetries that are maybe most relevant for optics, if you break inversion in a material, so if you have no center of inversion, then you will get second harmonic generation along some directions, but you might not get a preferred direction, you might not get a photocurrent, say, from unpolarized light, that requires a polar material. And then a chiral material is a different subset of inversion breaking, where you have no mirrors, it lets you have optical rotation, even if you don't break time reversal. So in other words, something like a Faraday effect, but in a non-magnetic material. So the magnitude of these things is what gets interesting when you think about topology. And topology's done a lot to maybe help us fill in what are the details of how optical responses work, the same way that it did for electrical responses previously. So the quick overview, as I said, I'm not going to define the Berry phase, but it's one way to look at both topological invariance and a lot of ordinary responses in solids, because we now have about 40 years of either topological phases that we can express in terms of the Berry phase of electrons, or things like electric polarization and the magnetoelectric effect, which are responses in a material that have something to do, again, with the Berry phase. And the focus in this talk is going to be on metals. I want to give one example of how things work in insulators beyond the Hall effect, which I think you already know. And for that, I'll say the magnetoelectric effect. So briefly, the Berry phase is something made from the wave functions of my crystal. In the Abelian case, I've got a non-degenerate state at every value of momentum, say, and I form this object, and it's very much like a vector potential that lives in momentum space. And just like the vector potential, it's not gauge invariant by itself, but I can make loop integrals and things like that that are gauge invariant. So I'm sorry if this is quick, but I think most people have seen slides like this before. So the first case of relating this Berry phase of the Bloch state, so again, just an object that I build out of the non-interacting electron wave function, it turns out that this has a nice set of geometric and even topological properties, and they're actually measurable. So what Thouless, Komodo, De Nice, and Nightingale said was, okay, take this curl of A, what we call the Berry curvature. So in a sense, how much are the wave functions evolving as I change momentum? And if you integrate that, so this thing inside the parentheses is just F, if you integrate that over the Brillouin zone, you get an integer for each band. And that integer tells you how, you know, knotted up is that band, if you like, in heuristic terms, but it also tells you how much that band contributes to the quantum Hall effect. So this is maybe the connection between a topological invariant of band structure and something you actually measure. And in insulators, that's now fairly well established, and there are even more subtle cases. In fact, the magnetoelectric effect is a case where not just the Abelian part, in other words, the part of this I can write with one wave function and that has a U1 gauge symmetry, but actually the non-Abelian part of the Berry connection matters. And then I'll come to semimetals in just a second, where we have to be a little bit more careful about what we actually measure. So the idea of this magnetoelectric effect is that we've known for a long time that when you go into a solid, for example, if you have a magnetoelectric material that breaks inversion, breaks time reversal, you generate terms in the electromagnetic Lagrangian like E dot B. So particle physicists were actually thinking about couplings like this, because one possible particle out there that might be some part of dark matter is called the axion, and this is how it would couple to electromagnetic fields. So for our purposes, just think of this as a term that might be there in a solid, and in the past we would always say that if we had time reversal symmetry and inversion symmetry, or inversion symmetry, this term would be gone. What Wilczek pointed out, and I'm going to give a condensed matter interpretation very quickly of what he said, is that the coefficient in the right units you should think of as an angle, something defined periodically between 0 and 2 pi. And because of that, it actually has two values in a system with time reversal invariance, because theta equal to 0 is equal to itself under time reversal. Theta is equal to minus theta. 0 is equal to minus 0, but pi is also equal to minus pi. So that means that all time reversal invariant insulators, this is really the point of this Wilczek paper, should be either theta equal to 0 materials or theta equal to pi materials. And now we realize that's true, and that's actually the ordinary and topological 3D insulators with time reversal. So how that works is a neat example of electromagnetic responses, and it actually involves the surface metal. So the way it's connected to the definition we normally give of a 3D topological insulator is the following. So normally we say a 3D topological insulator is something with an odd number of Dirac points. Here, we're saying that a 3D topological insulator is something that if I could gap the surfaces would have theta equal to pi. It turns out that this is a total derivative of the surface Chern-Simons term, so it's exactly the same as saying you've got half integer quantum Hall response on the surfaces. So it all hangs together if a 3D topological insulator surface state, when I can gap it, so if I can gap that odd number of Dirac fermions, I will wind up with half integer Hall effect rather than integer Hall effect. And to try to convince you that's actually true, there are experiments now by Peter Armitage and others seeing something related to that. But actually, here's older data on graphene, just showing that the quantum Hall plateaus you see on graphene, which are at like minus 10, minus 6, minus 2, 2, 6, 10 times E squared over H, these only make sense if you believe that one Dirac fermion has a half integer Hall effect. So everything kind of hangs together in the electromagnetic response of insulators, even though it's coming in this case from what used to be metallic surface states. So now on to metals, and this is kind of the Berry phase part of it for people who like theory. It's actually the non-abelian Berry phase and its Chern-Simons form that gives you that theta term, which is what you measure in the ordinary abelian electromagnetism. So this is, of course, one of these things that high-energy people have thought about a lot, but it turns out that if you make it out of the Berry gauge fields, you get something physical, and it's there in all magnetoelectric materials, not just the topological ones. And this is kind of a general lesson, that sometimes in understanding one of these topological phases or topological responses, it actually teaches you how to compute the response always, not just in topological phases, because there's usually a Berry phase piece that people might not have thought about, or at least not have recognized before. So metals, it turns out that the effect of wave function geometry in metals is actually even simpler to state than what it does in insulators, maybe. So what we sometimes cite as the biggest omission in Ashcroft and Merman is the second term in this equation. So when we think about a metal, our usual starting point to build up things like a Boltzmann equation or so on is the semi-classical motion of an electron wave packet. And this term, I think everyone has seen before. It's the fact that the velocity and things like that are modified when we go into a band structure. I get some effective velocity that's the group velocity from the band structure. It turns out that even this is too simple for one of the effects I'm going to talk about. So even this gets a semi-classical modification whenever you're in a magnetic field, and that puzzled us for a while, I have to admit. The second term is the Berry curvature term. This is the same Berry curvature I talked about before. And now there's been kind of a cottage industry of going back and figuring out what are various effects in metals that are actually dominated by the second term. So the classic example, what motivated Karplus and Luttinger and people like that to first introduce this term, was the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect in itinerant magnets, things like iron, where people like Hall had actually measured the Hall effect back in the 1890s. So I'm not going to say much about that. There are certainly experts in the audience. I'm going to focus on optics today and give two examples of optical properties that are determined by something related to this equation, at least at low frequency. The problem is, from those low frequency studies and from ordinary metals, you would conclude that, well, there are interesting things in a metal, but maybe not quantized. When you go to semi-metals, there's much more potential for quantization, because now your Fermi surface is just a point. But for real robust quantization, you'd like to find things that are robust even when the Fermi level is not exactly at, say, a Dirac point. And it turns out you can still see robust things, but you need to go to non-zero frequency, like in that graphene transmission example I gave earlier. So the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect, and there's a nice review article by Nagaosa and others from 2011, which is where this figure is from, is that if you look in samples that are not too clean and not too dirty, there's a region where the Hall effect in a magnetic metal seems to be controlled by this term, which is the same integral that gives me quantization in the quantum Hall effect, but now it's only over the Fermi C. So I don't go over the whole Brillouin zone. I only go over part of it, so I don't get quantization. So an optical effect that we thought about a long time ago, 2010, and now we're back to thinking about, but at non-zero frequency. We were first interested in it at low frequency because there is an experimental puzzle, and because it seemed like the Berry phase was the resolution to this puzzle, and I still believe that. So the effect is the following. Take, say, right circularly polarized light, and shine it on a metal, or left circularly polarized light, and ask, what is the part of the photocurrent that changes direction depending on whether I had right circular or left circular light? And a reason to understand why that's a Berry phase effect, and you can actually get it from the semi-classical equation I wrote down a second ago. So suppose I just apply an electric field to my simple semi-classical metal that pushes the electron distribution a little bit to the right, say. Right circularly polarized light means the light goes around like this, or the occupied states go around like that. The ordinary velocity averages to zero. The anomalous velocity does not, because if you have an inversion-breaking material, the Berry curvature and dk/dt come together and give you a non-zero effect, and we think that is actually what's seen in some old experiments, but this is very much like the anomalous Hall effect. It's not quantized at low frequency. It's basically semi-classical. So after that, we were happy that we thought we'd found a Berry phase effect, but we put it away for a while, and we started thinking about linear optics. And we had reasons to think about it that were motivated by some cuprate experiments that we still don't understand and that I won't get into. But it turns out that the problem we thought we were studying, which is linear optics in chiral materials, is exactly the same thing as the chiral magnetic effect that people have talked about in Weyl semimetals, which is the simplest linear effect you could look for to see Weyl points, although that effect in one form is zero, and in the other form is an old effect that is not very specific to Weyls. That's kind of the point of these two papers. So briefly, what is a Weyl semimetal? Well, I'm going to be quick again. So soon after Dirac came up with his 4x4 matrix equation, both Weyl and Majorana figured out two different ways that you could simplify that to a 2x2 matrix equation. And Weyl's way was to say, if I've got massless particles, I could split up the left-handed and right-handed particles, and they will never talk to each other, basically. And as I said, we thought that might be the case for neutrinos, but now we don't. We still think neutrinos might be Majoranas. And of course, there's been a great deal of work on band structure of Weyls and their consequences, including how to define Weyl points topologically. There's a nice paper on that by Murakami. And then consequences in terms of surface states in this important paper, which was a good clue to photo emission for how to look for these materials. I want to focus on bulk electromagnetic response here. And there's kind of a long and complicated story, which I'm going to explain as follows. So people in high energy physics have thought about Weyls for a long time, and it turns out that the simplest effect involves the same combination of electric and magnetic fields that appeared in the magnetoelectric effect a minute ago. In fact, they're even a bit related. So the idea was there's an anomaly in the sense that if you only have one Weyl point, you will break charge conservation, you will spontaneously create particles if you apply parallel electric and magnetic fields. Now that's not actually such a big problem, because the total charge of all the Weyl points in a crystal always turns out to be zero for topological reasons. But it's going to turn out that you need effects like this that involve two applied fields. So that could be magnetoconductivity, it could be nonlinear optics, whatever. But there was an effort to look for effects that only involved one field, say only involved B, And I will tell you very quickly about that because it leads to sort of a no-go theorem almost. At least it tells you why you might want to focus on nonlinear effects. And as I said, what I'm leading up to is this particular nonlinear effect. So I think I already mentioned the graphene example. This would be a linear quantized example. So it is possible, say, for 2D Dirac fermions, although I don't think of this as highly topological. It turns out that when you try to make an effect that is linear in B, this is the so-called chiral magnetic effect, currents responding to B. I think this is zero in equilibrium. I think that's generally accepted now. If you apply a time-varying B, then there is a response, which for a while was called transport chiral magnetic effect and things like that. But a time-varying magnetic field also induces an electric field, and you're basically just computing response to an electromagnetic wave, and it's actually just the optical rotation of the wave as it passes through a chiral material. And it turns out, after either an 8-page quantum calculation or a couple lines of semi-classical calculation, that this is the answer, this is the response tensor, where the only new ingredient that appears is the orbital magnetic moment of block states. And I'll tell you what that is in a second, but this is the other simple missing ingredient in the semi-classical theory of metals. So once you realize that, then this derivation is very simple. What that means is, normally the group velocity is the gradient of the energy. If you put on a magnetic field, there's an additional piece which is related to the orbital magnetic moment of a block state. Because remember, a block state is made up of some superposition of atomic orbitals. Those all have orbital angular momenta, and usually k-dependent orbital angular momenta, which means they contribute to this gradient. And this is actually the term that generates optical rotation at low frequency. And actually, this term, orbital magnetic moment, is from the same family of wave function objects as the Berry curvature. In fact, it is the Berry curvature, but with one extra power of the Hamiltonian inserted inside. For a simple two-band Weyl point or something, it's just energy times Berry curvature. So that's the linear effect. Now, on to nonlinear effects for the last 10 minutes. And here's the main takeaway, even before we come to topological theory and things like that, is just maybe you can find an application for this, because Chi2, the nonlinear optical response of tantalum arsenide, is extremely strong. This is a Nature Physics paper that I think was the original report, but it's seen by other groups as well. Maybe a way to state it is, so this was at one particular frequency, and then they did spectroscopy in the later paper. At the first frequency they studied, tantalum arsenide has Chi2 that's already about 10 times larger, say, than gallium arsenide, which is a very strong example. Similarly, barium titanate and the other things people use. If you go to slightly lower frequencies, it can be more like 50 times as large. The one problem in using this for the standard Chi2 applications is that normally we do nonlinear optics like frequency doubling with Chi2 and insulators, so there's very little loss. This is a semi-metal, which means there's a fair amount of linear conductivity, so there is loss. But if you have an application for Chi2, and right now the main applications are just in physics experiments, but if you had a real-world application that depends on large Chi2 but doesn't require having an insulator, that would be nice. Why that happens, we think, is just that this is an extremely polar material, and you can derive a sum rule relating nonlinear optical response to what's going on in the ground state, basically the third cumulant or the skewness of the ground state Wannier centers in simple models. I don't want to get into that because it's not super topological, and this is a topological workshop. So if you go to Weyl semimetals that are chiral, and I'll give you materials examples in a second, there's a different effect. It's actually that effect I mentioned earlier about photocurrents that depend on the chirality of the light, whether the light is right circular or left circular. That has a magnitude that isn't just quite large by the standards of that effect, but actually quantized. So here is the basic idea of this effect, and I'll show a little bit of the calculation, but I think the calculation is hard to explain in a minute or two. We want chiral Weyl semimetals. One consequence of that is that, say, the positive Weyl point can be at a different energy from the negative Weyl point. So the Nielsen-Nunemia theorem is that the total Weyl charge over all energies has to be zero, but I can spread them out, and this happens in several materials that we know. Then I think about optical transitions. So I could have optical transitions here across the Weyl point, while here, at the same frequency, those transitions are polyblocked, and instead I get optical transitions, say, that are intraband. And these are what we studied in 2010, and we know how to compute those, and they're not quantized, but they're not very large. So what happens if I look at the transition across the Weyl point? And the thing to stress is you might say, well, how could the topology come in? Because you're not actually at the wild points. In other words, you're writing some perturbation theory expression that involves the wave functions down here as the initial states and the wave functions up here as the final states. Remember, the whole point in saying that a wild point is topological means that you can't locally get rid of it. For example, you couldn't just open up a gap here without dramatically changing these states above and below it. The states above and below it have the topological imprint of the fact that they're around a wild point. So the question is, does that show up when you compute the nonlinear optical transitions across there? And there's kind of a long story of thinking about other things related to it, mostly in 2D, where people thought that maybe photocurrent would be interesting. It turns out when you go up to 3D, this is what you find, that the rate at which you inject current, and specifically the difference between right circular and left circular, so this is a 3D current density changing in time, that's proportional to the intensity of the light times fundamental constants times some integers, which are the wild points. So this is quantization of current injection at a wild point. It is topological in the sense it doesn't care about bending. It definitely does care, first of all, that you're in the right range of frequencies, and second, there are corrections from the other wild point hiding. And the real smoking gun for this effect is the following. So what I've just told you is you ought to get a very large and even quantized signal, and I'll say more about that in a second, from transitions across this wild point, but not from this one at this frequency. But if I keep increasing the frequency, then I ought to see transitions across this point become allowed. Once transitions across this point become allowed, this has the opposite wild charge, so it ought to cancel out that one. So I ought to get a very large and almost quantized nonlinear optical response for some range of frequencies that turns off when I hit the other wild point. If you're wondering where the quantization comes from, so just let me mention a couple things. So we had one or two materials proposals in our paper that seem hard to grow as crystals. The material where the experiment is actually done was experimentally studied by Zahid Hassan's group, and it's actually a multifold wild point, so it enhances by a factor of 4. And then the detailed theory calculation of both linear and nonlinear effects in this material is a paper. It actually involves several of the people I thanked at the beginning, but not me, which is a detailed microscopic calculation of what happens in rhodium silicide. And it predicts a particular feature, which is that the second wild point should start to kill the effect at frequencies above 0.7 eV. So here's a picture first of why the effect is quantized if you want a simple and then a slightly more complicated derivation. So here's the simple derivation. We've known for a long time what is the linear response conductivity of a Dirac point or wild point. It's got a factor of omega in the numerator, and it's got a factor of velocity in the denominator. So that's not very universal. At a wild point, in a simple linear dispersion picture, every transition is changing the velocity from v to minus v, which means the current change is from v to minus v, and that exactly cancels out this vf. So you get something that's independent of velocity in a linear model, but that doesn't sound very topological. You know, what if the bands bend and so on? What if the chemical potential changes and so on? That's where you need a somewhat better calculation, and we now have about 3 different ways to do this because we were obsessed with checking it and so on. At least in the non-interacting case, you can get from basically standard perturbation theory calculations or a flow K method or doing it in sort of more particle physics-y way. They all seem to agree that what you get is a current that is a transition rate times the group velocity as usual, but you can relate that to the Berry flux from this wild point, which is a monopole of Berry flux. So sorry if I can't cover this in more detail, but it's in the paper. So here's the experiment. The basic idea is you send in a pulse of light, so it's all done optically, no contacts, which is why it's hard to get the absolute magnitude. The light comes in, it creates a little pulse of current through this effect that's actually into the material. This is in rhodium silicide, which is a cubic crystal, and you measure the radiated light. And as I said, the prediction before the experiment was that there should be a plateau in the nonlinear response from low frequency up to about 0.7 eV. And that is seen. So this tailing off, we think, is hitting the other wild point. So this is on the archive. And as I said, I think the absolute magnitude is tough to get. And I think both because of contributions from the other wild point and because of contributions from disorder, and what we're now working on is contributions from interactions, I would take E cubed over H squared as more the natural scale than a rigid quantum. In that sense, it's very much like the graphene optical transition. But it does work about as well as one could hope for, especially the frequency dependence is exactly what one would hope for. So to conclude, before I've got one final wrap-up slide, since Leon is holding up a lot of signs at me, I think that means I'm supposed to finish up. In the conventional while, nonlinear optical responses are very strong. In the chiral while, the chiral photocurrent is strong, and theoretically, we claim it's quantized, and that's at least consistent with experiment, but hardly proven by the experiment. And that means if you look at, you know, forget about fractional cases, which are beautiful but hard. If you just look at the integer quanta and electromagnetic response, there's one set which I think of as ultimately related to flux quantization or the Aronov-Bohm effect, and that would be things like the Josen frequency that you measure. There's a class of E squared quanta. And then if this holds up, this is the first example, as far as I know, of an E cubed over H squared quanta. And I think it's the answer to what is the, you know, the thing you should try to measure to know that you've got a vowel point. I think you have to go to nonlinear optics, and this is maybe the simplest nonlinear thing to look for. So I think that's my concluding slide. If anyone wants to ask me about something more interacting, I would love to talk about triangular lattice compounds, because for at least a year we've been working on triangular lattice compounds, and in particular, we think there is a chiral spin liquid in the triangular lattice Hubbard model at intermediate coupling, close to the Mott transition, basically, so it's not just the Heisenberg model. And I think I will end by thanking my collaborators again. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, this doesn't seem to be, oh, there it goes. We're ready to open the talk to questions. Jairo?
Thanks, Jeff, for a wonderful talk. So when it looks to this effects, particularly being semi-metals and being the gaps or the frequency not very high, how robust then these interband transitions, which are effectively these various curvatures we are looking at, are to disorder compared to the quantum Hall effect, which is very robust?
It's definitely not as robust as the quantum Hall effect. I think a better case is the anomalous Hall effect. That's a better comparison, which I think, so we did actually just post a paper, which I didn't put here, which is on one way to try to get around disorder. So the way I'd put it is this way. I think the even aside from the interband part, the part is simply that you're producing a zero frequency DC current outcome. If you're doing that, then that does seem to be fairly sensitive to disorder. So for example, I think it's like the anomalous Hall effect, where in the anomalous Hall effect, if you want to make a, you know, bizarre model of disorder, you can weaken the effect greatly. But it seems experimentally that the effect is, you know, is there and is of the right magnitude. So I think the ultimate proof, if you like, is experimental in the anomalous Hall case. I mean, maybe that's not the current understanding, but that's my understanding. So one trick that we have here to try to get around that, if you can do difference frequency generation, so if you've got a laser which has multiple frequencies, let's say you've got omega 1 and omega 2, you could have this effect at some small non-zero frequency, which will make it less sensitive to disorder. So that's one strategy. But I think that's actually already what's going on in the experiment, maybe, because this experiment is done in the time domain. It's producing a fairly short pulse. So I don't think you're sensitive to the very long time disorder cancellations that might be there if you're truly DC. But I guess my feeling, based on the anomalous Hall effect, which I think is the most well-known or well-studied example of a geometrical wave function property in a metal, is that, you know, in the anomalous Hall effect, E squared over H remains the right scale, and even the anisotropy tends to be what's predicted by theory. So I think it's very clearly right in some sense, but it seems like the effect of disorder is not at the 0.1% level.
More questions? Yeah.
Thanks. Joe, I had a question to the what you mentioned about the chiral magnetic effect. So the linear order, you know, you wrote the tensor alpha that relates the current to the field, and you made the remark that in the absence of time reversal, you shouldn't see anything at DC. However, at finite frequencies, there is a response. So in that part of the story, which I realize is not the main subject of your talk, sure, could you summarize what is the main effect of the frequency dependence? What do you expect
to
see?
Yeah, so the idea, so I think what sometimes, another one of Bloch's theorems, probably his second most famous theorem, is that systems tend to reach equilibrium without transport currents and magnetic fields. So what people realized that before us, and then they thought, well, what if you put a time-varying magnetic field? Then you get something, and that's correct. But we tried to rename it the gyrotropic magnetic effect, because first of all, it's a tensor response. Second, it really is just optical rotation. So what I claimed was, if you time vary B, so if you let the system reach equilibrium in B, you'll get zero. If you time vary B, you'll get a non-zero answer. But that non-zero answer is actually the response to the electromagnetic wave that includes both B and E through Maxwell's equations. And that response is just, as you pass the light through a material at low frequency, how much does the plane of polarization rotate because the material is chiral? So that's the gyrotropic magnetic effect. But it's what, you know, you could find it in Landau and Lifshitz say is optical rotation. And it does turn out that, in a sense, if you try to analyze it semi-classically, where it's coming from is really the magnetic field. It's the magnetic field term here in the group velocity. So that's how it all kind of comes together. So the two papers that realized this at about the same time are, I've got the other one, Ars and Dima Pessin and his student. So I think they, you know, may view this as more related to the transport effect than we do. We would say that really this is not a transport effect, this is a response to a wave, and it's a tensor, so it's really just optical gyrotropy. I guess that's our viewpoint. Right. But I think the actual calculation is...
And it relies on non-zero M, which here, if I understood correctly, is the Berry curvature, correct?
M is closely related to the Berry curvature, but it's actually the orbital magnetic moment of the block electron. So the formula for it is here. So this would be the Berry curvature, except it's got this thing inside. So this is something that, yes, I wish I'd learned in grad school because it would have saved us 6 months or so. But this is, yeah, Eva Souza is the one who said, oh, of course I know what that is. That's the orbital magnetic moment. It's kind of well known in like the polarization and Berry phase electronic structure community that when you calculate the orbital magnetization of a magnetic solid, there are various pieces. But one of them is just the fact that your block electron, you know, it may be made up of, say, orbitals that are rotating one way, and that means there'll be some moment from the orbital motion, and then that will depend on K. And because that depends on K, you get an extra contribution to the velocity. So that's basically the effect. And, you know, we have some 8 pages of supplemental material confirming that we first did the calculation quantum mechanically, and then semi-classics is just a couple of lines once you realize this is the term that matters.
And so conceptually, could you relate it to the topic of the talk, which is the vial? If you actually measured this in a vial semi-metal, what would you see?
Yeah, I think I might have a slide on that that I took out, but let me see if I can call it up. So the short answer is you get something that is very simple in a simple Y model, but not universal because it involves the splitting between the wild points. Oops. Sorry. All right. Yeah, I'll just stick with this. I think you can read it. So there. The current that you get, if you want to write it in the form of the CME, the two differences are there's a factor of 1/3, which is maybe just a clue that this is not the same thing. But second, you get the energy difference between the wild points. You get a non-universal factor. But the reason why this appears, if you like, this is in a simple, you know, perfectly linear dispersing wild point. But if you add other corrections and so on, you know, there's no quantization of this effect would be the claim. So it's simple in the simplest possible wild point, because there's only basically one parameter in that, which is either the velocity or the energy, and this is what it looks like.
Okay, I'll ask a question then. Can you say anything about kind of really non-equilibrium here? I mean, you're talking about nonlinear response. Presumably there is some heating, some changing of the electron distribution function. Do those things enter at all?
Yes.
Normally, when we talk about quantization, they're very tied to zero temperature.
Yeah. So there's a deep level at which they enter, and then where I can answer it is at a simple level. So here, what's quantized is this response starting from the initial state. Certainly, after some amount of time, you're not in that initial state anymore, and it's no longer clear that anything is quantized once your electron distribution has both, what was originally low-lying states and high-lying states as well. So the practical issue is more, this is the rate at which you increase current. You'd expect to reach a steady state, assuming you've got some disorder relaxation in the material. So it is very different from the quantum Hall effect, where it's J that's quantized. Here it's DJ that's DT. It's the rate at which you're putting things in that will reach some equilibrium. And that means there's even in a simple like relaxation time model of disorder, there's a factor tau of relaxation time. So the way to see that this is quantized is to work in the time domain and measure it as some quick pulse from the initial state, which is fortunately close to what the experiment does.
And how long are the pulses compared to this?
So tau, what you want is in this experiment, they are not in the ideal regime, which means they have to estimate tau from sigma 1, basically from linear response. And that's tricky because it's not clear that that's actually the right tau, because that's kind of tau at low frequency. Exactly. So that is one reason why the overall magnitude is something that I think we can't really claim is quantized.
Okay.
I mean, we can't claim that we know the overall magnitude. It's at least the right scale, but you know, factor of two would not at all be surprising. So if you could do it faster, which mostly means having a cleaner material so that tau is longer, and they're trying. So rhodium silicide was the original material. I think gadolinium platinum is what's currently being one material that people are trying. I mean, there are a couple of groups doing this now. So Liang Wu at Penn is also working on this. So I don't think we've found the ideal material yet. And it's always a tricky measurement. Basically, when you're doing this pulse, to measure the magnitude of a sub-picosecond pulse of current by the radiation it produces is a little tricky. You have a lot of factors you have to estimate to get, you know, from that little pulse to your detector. I don't think the precision of the measurement, so we would say the precision of the quantization is maybe 10%, we'd be ecstatic. The precision of the measurement is hard to get below 10% or so.
I see, I didn't even appreciate. So they're measuring, the current is being measured by the radiation it produces, is that right?
Yeah, let me show my little... Yeah, so basically what happens is you've got a high frequency pulse coming in, and then yeah, what comes out is related to the envelope of the pulse that came in because it's a DC effect. Yeah, so you're not actually, you don't have contacts. It's all optical.
But there's not some other way to directly interrogate the electron distribution function, perhaps. Interrogate the current, maybe.
One could imagine. I mean, the people do a lot of things, but with the precision, I'm not sure. Like, you know, you can do time-resolved ARPES to try to see the instantaneous spectral function after a pulse. That would be neat, but yeah, I don't know of any practical way that someone is trying.
Okay. I'm sorry, I think I need to call this. I wasted too much of the time of the session. I need to call it to an end here so we have time for the next talk, but let's thank Joel again. There'll be plenty of time during the coffee break to ask Joel more questions.